No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host, Marilia Duffels, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. Unfortunately, Marilia is not available today, but I have two very special guests. And if you tuned into the show last week, you know that we talked to two really wonderful guests who, Dr. Laura Brown and Ruth Ben-Gait, I guess, and they took the position that Donald Trump should not be prosecuted. Well, we have a couple of experts today that might have a slightly different view, and I think that's interesting, and we really need to discuss it. And they are Mr. Asher Hildebrand, who is an associate professor of practice in Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. His academic interests include American politics, legislative institutions, can't read my own writing, civic participation, and advocacy. Also democratic democracy and U.S. foreign policy. And he spent 15 years in Congress and on political campaigns, holding a leadership position as chief of staff for Representative David Price of North Carolina. We also have with us Aziz Huck. He is a Frank and Bernice Jane J. Greenberg, professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. He's a scholar and U.S. and comparative constitutional law. He works on topics ranging from democratic backsliding, God, do I have some questions for you, to regulating AI. He works as a counsel and then as a director of the Brennan Center of Liberty and National Security, and he was a law clerk for Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, God bless you, and has also written for the New York Times and the Washington Post. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being on the show. Let me start with you, Mr. Hildebrand. In U.S. News and World Report, you said that prosecuting Trump can make him a martyr. Do you think that's really I got to tell you, I have that sentiment. And I wonder what leads you to believe that may happen.
Well, first of all, thanks, Senator, for the service you give the residents of the District of Columbia, where I used to live, and also for having us on the program. Yeah. And I think that the nation and the Department of Justice really face a terrible dilemma here, because if they choose to prosecute Donald Trump, they do risk civil unrest, perhaps even civil war, sort of further martyring him in the view of his supporters. But the other half of what I said to U.S. News and World Report is that I think actually that the alternative is even worse, that not prosecuting him would have even greater consequences by sending a signal of impunity for trying to overturn the will of the American voters at a time when democracy is really hanging in the balance. So it's a dilemma that no country, no attorney general, no president should have to face, but it's the one we find ourselves in right now.
And do you agree with that, Mr. Huck? Do you think that we'll end up, if we prosecute him, we'll end up making him a martyr and making things worse?
I agree with that assessment. I think that the country is caught in a double bind. I think that the actions of the former president demonstrate the ways in which a elected official, particularly the president, him or herself, can engage in lawless or perhaps illegal behavior that places the country at a structural double bind, either forego justice in the individual case with the loss of the signal that wrongdoing will be identified, condemned, and punished, or pursue a path that doesn't just risk creating a aura of martyrdom around the former president in ways that exacerbate civic tensions, but that seem to strike directly at the principle of democracy as a system in which multiple parties compete for power, and when one party is out of power, it doesn't need to worry about the governing authority using their temporary hold in power to coerce or silence the opposition. It might be that that coercion or silence is justified by the facts of what the former president did, but that doesn't change the impression that governing power would be used to silence an opposition leader in ways that are deeply problematic in a democratic system that is committed to the peaceful transfer of power and a world in which opposition leaders do not need to worry about having the fact of their opposition criminalized.
Well, you know, I agree with a lot of what you just said, but can I ask you, do you think that we have another path? Is there another path? Is prosecuting Mark Meadows, Rudolph Giuliani, all the people that were around the president that facilitated this, facilitated him in his delusions, would that accomplish the same thing? If we put them in jail, does that vindicate the system and make it all right, or do we need to prosecute him?
I think that there's a multiplicity of other paths. And the problem is that the same lack of political will, the same fragmentation of our public sphere into some elements that are highly partisan and unreliable sources of information yield similar kinds of problems if one takes those alternative paths. So absolutely, you're right, that one possibility is to use the prosecution of those who were working alongside former President Trump, Meadows, Giuliani, Eastman, in ways that, A, demonstrate directly the illegality of the underlying schemes to obstruct the role of Congress in counting electoral votes, but B, use those trials as showcases for the criminality of or the criminal actions alleged to have been taken by the former president. Something like this happened in the Nixon era also, where trials of Nixon subordinates became vehicles for illustrating the criminal actions that Nixon himself had taken. So it's not impossible that these trials could have that effect and have the signaling consequences. Two other options I'd very, very quickly put on the table. The first, it's useful to remember that we have states as well as the federal government. And even though the New York district attorney, for reasons that are, I think, quite unclear, has abandoned the investigation and potential prosecution of the former president, Georgia prosecutors continue to investigate the president's role with respect to these specific events. And it's not inconceivable that a Georgia grand jury might hand down a prosecution in ways that I think don't implicate the same concern about the peaceful transition of power and the role of an opposition, because it's not the person in power in the national office who is leading the prosecution. So there is the Georgia prosecution. The third option I'd put on the table is the United States, like almost every other democratic country, has a constitution in which criminal sanctions are not the only vehicles for punishing elected actors or for sanctioning elected actors who use their power against the democratic system. It's also why we have, one of the reasons why we have impeachment. Impeachment was tried, it didn't work. There is also Section 3 of the 14th Amendment that permits actors who have engaged in certain kinds of insurrectionary conduct to be excluded from national politics. That's a less severe and therefore less likely to produce the public aura of martyrship option that if there were political will in Congress, and as you know as well as I do, that's a big, big if, would be a potent alternative to the possibility of criminal prosecution.
Well, let me ask you, I think the fact that you brought up Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, that's something I've asked my guests that have discussed this previously, and they were unclear on how that would work. But I think that's a really good idea. But let me ask you, Mr. Hildebrand, since you have experience as a staffer in Congress, that's just not going to happen if the Republicans take over the House, right? We're not going to invoke the 14th Amendment provision, which, by the way, says that anybody basically that's had an elected office who is involved in an insurrection or it facilitates people that are involved in insurrection can be removed by Congress. That wouldn't happen, do you think, Mr. Hildebrand?
The short answer is no. I mean, I think it's a very appealing possibility for the reasons that Aziz says. It could be a form of accountability, a potentially powerful form of accountability that sends the signal that the actions of President Trump are not acceptable in a democracy, without also invoking the kind of fraught question of prosecuting him with the full power of the federal government and the current administration. I think there are a couple of problems with it. One is, the slim chances that a Congress that's already quite polarized, in which the Republican Party would not even participate in the January 6th committee hearings in the first place, would take action on it. And Aziz knows much more than I on the mechanics of this, but my understanding is that it would be a heavy lift. But the other issue I worry about, and this is just another inherent dilemma we're facing here, is that while Donald Trump himself might perceive the being ruled ineligible for future office as a pretty significant penalty, a pretty significant form of accountability, I do worry that this is no longer just about Donald Trump. Of course, this is about now a growing number of candidates, elected officials all over the country who are proponents of the big lie, who are not even in all cases necessarily joined at the hip to Trump. This is now a movement that is much broader than Trump, and I feel like it's beyond the mandate of the January 6th committee or even the Department of Justice to sort of get the genie back in the bottle. That's not a realistic expectation. I do feel like that criminal prosecution sends a powerful signal, not just to Donald Trump, but for all of the other elected officials that are out there endorsing the big lie, looking at this, because if we're ever going to kind of get a hold on this virus that is metastasized now throughout the Republican Party around the country, then it's got to be by changing the incentives that elected officials are facing as they're talking about this. And I just I think that calls for the most powerful remedy possible. I say that, though, in full acknowledgement that there are some significant trade-offs, and so it's just not an easy question.
Well, you know, the point that you bring up about, you know, the metastasizing of this movement, we certainly see, I think, that the January 6th committee, if they've done anything, they've put Trump in a position now where I think other Republicans are willing to stand up against him. So if that's true, I mean, assuming that this man runs again and gets into the primary, won't he tear apart the Republican Party, given that there's these two factions? And is it one faction of the party? Wouldn't they be interested in getting rid of him politically, putting him into, you know, putting him into out to pasture? You think that might increase the ability that they'd be able to do something under the 14th Amendment?
I don't know about the 14th Amendment, and I'll let Aziz speak to that.
Okay.
This answer won't surprise you because I am a Democrat. I've worked for Democrats. But I see personally the best case scenario politically being a very divisive Republican primary between Donald Trump and another candidate, whether it's Ron DeSantis or anybody else. And that fractures the party and creates space for the reemergence of a center-right Republican Party committed to principles of democracy, and I'm not naive about a third party, but I guess that's a possibility as well. I think the other two scenarios we're looking at, which are probably more likely, are one, Trump is jettisoned by Republican elites because he's been damaged by his conduct and by the January 6 hearings, and they rally around an alternative who may be not Donald Trump, but is not necessarily more committed to democratic principles and to upholding the rule of law. And then the worst case scenario to me is the coalescence around Donald Trump, rallying back around Donald Trump and allowing him to to run for president and to pursue election subversion again, with the benefit of having learned how to succeed through his experience so far. And that's not a political judgment purely, because I actually think politically a lot of Democrats would rather have Donald Trump on the ticket than to have a Ron DeSantis or another candidate seen as more formidable. But in terms of preserving American democracy, I personally don't want to see Donald Trump anywhere near an Electoral College majority ever again.
Well, I agree with you 100%. As a Democrat, I say, go Larry Hogan. Get somebody in there that's more of a centrist. I agree with that. And unfortunately, what you said rings so true. When we see Democrats now, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee just gave $430,000 to a Trump candidate because they want him to win in the primary against a Republican who stood up against Trump and voted for impeachment because they think he'll be easier to beat in the general election. So I hope it's not true that, you know, that we get Trump and the Democrats figure he's easier to beat. Let me ask you, Aziz, what do you think legally, since you're a lawyer, what do you think legally would be our chances? The thing that I fear is that this gets out there. The one thing the guy has excelled at is litigation. He can tie things up. He's got more lawyers than, you know, Carter has liver pills, as we used to say. But what do you think the chances are? No president has ever gone to jail. Do you think there's any chance at all that he could be prosecuted and put in jail?
I think that there are a number of potential charges that could be brought as a matter of federal criminal law. I do not know what the charges that are available in Georgia are. And I would flag again that it might be that practically the Georgia proceedings, which is well into the grand jury phase, are more likely to bear fruit than the federal charges. At the federal level, I think it is clear that with respect to, for example, the charge of obstructing the function of Congress with respect to an official act, where the official act was the counting of Electoral College votes on January the 6th, there is a substantial body of testimonial and documentary evidence, much of which has been gathered by the January 6th committee, that is supportive of some, but perhaps not every single one, of the different points of fact that a prosecutor would have to not just allege, but prove up with respect to the former president. My understanding of the evidence that's been produced so far is the most difficult point of law that would be presented in that hypothetical prosecution, and the one that a prosecutor would grapple with the hardest, is the need to point to some affirmative action that the president took that led directly and led predictably to the violence that occurred in the morning and afternoon of that day. I'm well aware of the content of the particular speech that he gave that morning. I'm well aware of the evidence about what he said to his staff, the earlier statements that he had made to groups like the Proud Boys. I still think that there is a reasonable prosecutor would really have to grapple with whether that was sufficient evidence on that point. I guess I'd add one other thing, which is there is an argument that is circulating online to the effect that the Attorney General does not have discretion with respect to whether to bring charges. If the Attorney General is presented with the evidence that demonstrates that there was a criminal act, at that point, it's up to the Attorney General to bring charges. They don't have any choice in the matter.
Well, you know, I can tell you as a layman that what you just outlined is one of my big problems, because I think to myself, hey, look, if I told my buddy that, you know, my buddy said he needed money and I said, here, go rob a liquor store, and they caught him, they wouldn't prosecute me, they'd prosecute him. So that's a problem I have. Like, are we going to be able to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt that his words are really what led people that showed up armed and ready to roll anyway? I mean, that seems like a big problem. I think you're exactly right. Mr. Hildebrand, I want to ask you, you said, because this is very important to me, I speak internationally on several occasions. And by the way, when Trump was in office and I would go to these international conferences, they had no interest in speaking to me about what the subject matter was. People everywhere I went, Portugal, India, Scotland, I spoke in all these places, all they wanted to talk about was Donald Trump. And, you know, we have this image of being the great leaders of democracy. And you said in that article that this could be a nail in the coffin of the myth of American exceptionalism. And that really, really bothers me. I think it rings true. Can you explain that?
Well, first, I'd commend you to some of the great work Aziz has done on sort of comparing our democratic erosion in the United States to the experience of other countries. Mm-hmm. When I was working in Congress, I spent a lot of time traveling around, working with legislatures in emerging democracies around the world through something called the House Democracy Partnership, which is a bipartisan commission that works to strengthen the development of democracy and especially parliamentary democracy in about 22 countries around the world. And I often found ourselves traveling with groups of bipartisan groups of members of Congress as well as staff, cast in the position of having to sort of say, follow, do as we say and not as we do.
Yeah.
In other words, to talk about all of the reasons why the American experience with democracy might not be applicable overseas. Even then, though, I was always struck by the reverence with which many of our counterparts abroad held the sort of first principles of democracy, the longevity of our Constitution, the primacy of the legislative branch, or at least in theory, the primacy of the legislative branch. But it's been clear for some time now that we've never lived up to those initial ideals, and that insofar as we've ever been a fully inclusive multiracial democracy, it's only been for the last half century or so, and that we are in fact fairly young as a democracy in that respect. And so all I meant there is that if there was any doubt about that before this experience, you know, the events of Donald Trump's presidency, of 2020 election, and of January 6, 2021 were yet another sort of nail in the coffin of those doubts. And I say that not to be overly critical or pessimistic, but as someone who has experienced the reverence that many in the world show for the ideals that this country was built on.
Well, that's certainly my experience. First of all, you're talking to a guy without a vote, so I understand that we don't always live up to our principles. But I got to tell you, and I'd like Aziz to comment on this since he knows a lot about it. But I went to India, and they have a guy over there named Modi, who you guys are probably familiar with, and he's much like Trump in many ways. All they wanted to talk to me about was, you know, what we were doing in the United States. And everybody I talked to saw America as a leader in democracy. How do you think this hurts us, Aziz, internationally?
Well, I think Asher put the state of play very well. I think that I would just add to the incisive comments that he just made that this perceived and I think actual deterioration in the quality of American democratic institutions happens to coincide with a more general return to what you might call great power politics, with nations like Russia, but also China, resisting the global system of institutions that was put in place largely thanks to the United States in the wake of World War II, a global set of institutions that has been critiqued, I think, fairly in many ways, but one of which aims was to at least in name to advance liberal democracy and the suite of personal freedoms that come under it. Obviously, it didn't always work that way, but that was what the orientation of the system was toward. So I think that we're at a moment at which Russia and China in particular are bucking against the international system that's been in place for 70-odd years now, where they're offering distinctive versions of what it means to be a good state in which democracy does not play a role, or democracy does not play the kind of meaningful role that particularly, again, to repeat something Asher said, it's come to play in the last 50 years in the United States. So this is not just a moment of our weakness, it's a moment of strength on the part of other actors on the international stage.
Yeah, let me add to that that we had a cabinet secretary, Jack Kemp, who was a Republican and supported our efforts to get a vote in Congress. And he said that's why he supported it, because he went to China to talk about human rights. And that's the first thing they said to him. Don't lecture us when you don't even let the people of your capital city vote. Mr. Hildebrand, I know you have to leave early, so I want to ask you before you go, if you have to leave, is there anything else you want to add to what you said today?
I appreciate, I think you all have, this has been a really interesting conversation, and I've appreciated both of your insights on the question. And I'll just close with what I opened with, which is that this is a terrible dilemma that no democracy should have to face. I personally believe that the benefits of prosecuting or indicting Donald Trump outweigh the costs, but it's an awfully difficult calculation. And so I'm just hopeful that that coming out of this, sort of in addition to whatever legal proceeding comes out of this and whatever the outcome is of that, that one thing that comes out of the January 6th committee's work and through the public debate that it has fostered is a renewed commitment on the part of the American people to upholding democratic principles. There's a kind of a conventional wisdom that that our views are so entrenched, that we're so polarized, that that nothing the committee can say or do is going to make an impact. And if you look just at aggregate data at Donald Trump's popularity or his favorability or these sort of big questions, then it's hard to detect much movement. But if you look below the surface a little bit, you've already seen some really important movement that could have an impact in the margins. That includes among independent voters, for example, far more significant increase in the number of Americans who view the events of January 6th as an insurrection, and a commensurate reduction in the number of Americans who view it as an act of peaceful protest. You see, of course, within the Republican Party, more openness to candidates other than Donald Trump in 2024. And I'm hopeful that you will see, again, the sort of majority of Americans who remains committed to principles of democracy, including the peaceful transition of power, that commitment is solidified, because in addition to whatever legal proceeding we have, the best and the only insurance policy we have in the long run of repeating this is going to be through that public commitment. So I appreciate you having me on, and sorry I have to leave a little early.
Well, we appreciate you being here, and thank you so much for the important work you do. And I hope as this proceeds, somewhere down the line, we'll all be able to get back together and I'll be able to say, yeah, you were absolutely right, because I have the same hopes you do. So thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Hildebrand.
Take care. Take care.
So Aziz, it's you and me, and I think that Mr. Hildebrand's brought up the the 800-pound gorilla in the room. What's more important, unity or accountability? It's, you know, we're going to tear the country apart by prosecuting him, possibly, but is that more important than bringing the country back together somehow?
I think that's a great way of putting the question, Senator. I think one way into it is to ask, well, why is there a tension in the first place? Why is it that the pursuit of accountability here leads to disunity? And I think that there's a couple of things that are worth pointing out here. One is that it's really important how senior Republicans, particularly longstanding members of the party, react to the information that's being produced by the January 6th committee. And I think here you've seen a real difference between a lot of the elected officials who have either been quiescent or critical of the January 6th committee, people like Elise Stefanik, I'd give us an example. And people who are longstanding Republicans who are not elected officials. So there's a number of former judges who have publicly condemned and in detail explained the fallacies of the theory of alternate electors that John Eastman, along with the former president, were advancing. So I think we have to think about what the role of elites here is. And then I think it's really important to see that one of the big reasons why there is a tension between accountability and unity is that there's a slice of the American public that is not at all being exposed to the information that the January 6th committee is producing. That there's a slice of the American people that are being told things that I think are at bottom factually false. And this is not, this is a problem that's often blamed upon social media. Social media clearly has a role here. But talk radio and cable news has potentially an even more important role here in shaping people's understanding. For very, very good reason, the freedom of those actors to speak and to decide what to say is protected constitutionally by the First Amendment. But it is one thing to say that speech is protected by the First Amendment. It is quite another thing to say that the exercise of that speech, the decision about whether to tell the truth or to tell a lie, has been responsibly exercised. And I think that part of the challenge of the situation we're in is the fact that what are rightly First Amendment freedoms are being exercised in ways that are irresponsible, that are antithetical to the project of unity with accountability.
Yeah, well, I can't disagree with that. And we certainly have seen, I think, you know, that my personal opinion is that people don't go out and search for the truth as easy. They go out and they look for things that make them feel comfortable with what they already believe. They go out and they look for facts that support whatever their particular belief is, no matter how ridiculous it is. I mean, you know, that we've got people from other countries sending in ballots and all this kind of ridiculous stuff. I don't think it matters to them. And I think also, as Mr. Hildebrand pointed out, we're always going for the people on the margins. We know that we're not going to change the minds of the people we call the Trumpers. So, given that that we have those obstacles, what do you think? I hope I'm not being redundant here, but do we have any hope under the 14th Amendment? Do we have any hope in by prosecuting Giuliani and Meadows and the other people that have been involved, or do we really? Do you really think we need to get him? We need to get him. We need to make an example. And let me just tell you something that I totally disagree with. The woman that we had on the show last week, who were great, they said one of the reasons that we have to do this is that it has to be a deterrent. Well, I don't believe if Donald Trump knew that he stood to get prosecuted and go to jail, that that would have modified his behavior. What do you think? Do you think it can be a deterrent to prosecute him?
I think it's unlikely that you would see a deterrent in the particular sense that if Donald Trump were prosecuted, future actors, because of that prosecution, would believe that they couldn't get away with behavior that was anti-democratic the use of official powers. I think that it's likely that just as with ordinary crime, the fact that one person is prosecuted for theft or for murder doesn't stop other people engaging in theft or murder, right? We just don't, in ordinary criminal law, see deterrence working that well. I think the more important effect of a criminal prosecution, and I want to emphasize how well Asher, I think, put the difficulty of judging whether, if one was possible, it would be also wise. I think that, that the most important effect of that, if it were to proceed, would be to reset public expectations across the board, or as widely across the board as one could, of what appropriate behavior in office is. And so I think it's not so much that we might see deterrence occurring. It's that a criminal prosecution might lead to a reinforcement of certain norms which are important in a democracy.
Well, I have to agree with you. You know, politicians get, this is especially true in politics, because politicians get caught all the time for stealing money and prosecuted and go to jail, but it doesn't seem to stop a bunch of them from continuing to do that. Let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. Hildebrand. What is it? Is there something that you'd like to say that I'm not asking? Is there a point that you think it needs to be made that we haven't covered yet?
I think that there's a question that's worth asking, but I'm going to confess before I put it on the table that I don't know the answer to the question. I think one thing that we see today is a tremendous number of people who are open to misinformation, and in particular misinformation about the 2020 election and what happened leading up to January the 6th. I think it's important to ask why people are open to that misinformation. What is it about our moment in America's political history that makes people so receptive to, I'm just going to call them lies, when there is information out there readily available that shows these lies to be untrue? What is it about our moment that makes it so ripe for misinformation? And I don't have an answer to that question, and it's a question about society as a whole. It's a really hard question to answer, but it is, I think, a really important question.
I agree that's an important question, and I think that the Democratic Party, for example, of which I've been a member, it seems like my whole life, needs to take some responsibility for this, because I think that the environment, you know, I don't think Trump got to the White House because of his charisma and good looks. I think he got to the White House because the environment was ripe for somebody like him to emerge. And we've seen this, like I said, in other places in the world. We've certainly seen it in England. We've seen it in India. We've seen it in Brazil, that these populists are growing because of and moving up because of the environment they're in. So I think you're right, and I think we need to change the environment, and we need to take a little responsibility for it. Because, again, I think people go out and look for verification of the way they feel. And when the president of the United States stands up there and says the election was stolen, that's enough verification for a lot of people. So what do we do now? If they made you, they appointed you president tomorrow, what can we do, Mr. Huck, to move the country forward? Do you think that the simple answer is to prosecute him? Obviously, there is no simple answer to this. But do you have any ideas of how we move forward beyond Donald Trump?
I think that, well, first of all, nobody's going to appoint me professor, me a mere professor president, not least because I'm not a natural born citizen, so I'm not eligible for the office. So let's just get that straight to begin with. I do think that there's certainly things that Congress can do. I think that reforming the Electoral Count Act is extraordinarily important. I think that addressing the economic worries of voters in a more robust form than the administration has been doing, and communicating that. I think communicating the value of loyalty to the American vision of democracy, which I think is not something that can be said for Donald Trump, is an important rhetorical thing that the administration has not done effectively. There's reforms such as coming up with a revised structure for Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, implementing legislative constraints on the White House's abuse of its control over the Justice Department. There's lots of things that can be done that were being discussed in the period of the campaign that we don't seem to have had movement on. So it's not that there's a shortage of ideas. It's much more that there's a shortage of either bandwidth or political will at this moment, even among the parties who you would think would be best positioned and best motivated to act. And on that score, I'm want to echo and second what you said right at the beginning of your comments just now about, you know, we really need to take seriously the role of the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party.
Yeah, I think we do. And I think that, you know, we're not acting out in the best ways. But we should also point out, don't you think, that the system held. I think that's an important point to make, that you had people like Raftsberger in Georgia and the guy in Pennsylvania who I can't remember, but you had these people who were Trump supporters, the guy in Texas, the attorney general in Texas. You had all these people that were Trump supporters, but when it came down to it, they stood up for the system. Did they not?
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And that was true even of people in the White House. And let's be clear, it was even true of Vice President Pence. Vice President Pence did not agree to any of the illegal schemes for either holding up or derailing the counting of electoral college votes on January the 6th. That's important to emphasize.
Yeah, and I should say I lament the fact. I think he would be a good Republican candidate, but I can tell you as a campaigner for 40 years, Vice President Pence is not very exciting, unfortunately. So do we just keep the electoral, you know, this has been a big thing in Congress over the last few years. Do we keep the Electoral College the way it is? Do we need to reform the Electoral College from your perspective? There's people who want to get rid of the Electoral College. Didn't the Electoral College help save our democracy in this case?
I think that there are powerful reasons to reform the Electoral College from democratic first principles. I think that the not just the exclusion of certain members of the American polity, but the disproportionate power exercised by residents of small states is a very good reason for reforming the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Electoral College is part of the Constitution's text, which means that a change to the Electoral College would have to come about through some kind of dramatic textual constitutional change. There has been talk of a convention being held under Article 5 of the Constitution, and indeed there's been an effort that's ongoing to collect state ratifications for the purpose of triggering that convention, largely with an eye to introducing a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. I am skeptical that the country is in a place where if a constitutional convention was held, we would come up with something constructive. I worry that trying to do major constitutional reform where, say, the Electoral College was on the table would precipitate worse kinds of social and even violent conflict than we have now. So absolutely, in an ideal world, be great to reform the Electoral College. The problem is we don't have a way of getting there that doesn't have at least the risk of creating unacceptable social and human costs.
Well, I agree with that. I think it's a very, very tough thing to do, and I think it's a close call in some cases, even though reform in some ways would be a good thing. Let me ask you, before I let you go, this final question, since you deal with young people, you teach in law school, do you have the feeling that we have the young people have the same sense of America that, well, I'm an old guy. So growing up, you know, we always, there was a sense that we were in the greatest democracy in the world. Do young people still feel that, you think?
I think that there is more division and more disagreement and more disillusionment about among young people than there was in the past. I think that both on the left and the right, and I happen to teach an institution where we have substantial representation from both conservative and liberal students, there is a profound sense of uncertainty about the future. I think that uncertainty takes very different forms. For example, the students that I have who are LGBTQ have anxieties that the conservative students who are not, who are straight, just don't have. Mm-hmm. I think that the way in which those students are responding to these anxieties is very, very varied. Some of them are becoming radicalized. Some of them are becoming apathetic. It's very hard to see how that, it's very hard, at least for me, to predict how that all will play out. But you're absolutely right to say that the young people, the teenagers, the early 20-somethings of today are in a really different position than the analogous generation, let's say 20 or 30 years ago.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I mean, we shouldn't make these kids mortgage your future to pay for their education. That's one thing right there that changes their position. I put myself through college and graduate school, and I think it cost me $1,000 a year. Anyway, I thank you so much for being with us, Mr. Hawk. You've been a great guest. I think this is conversation that's going to have to go on and on and on for a while until we see how things develop. But I appreciate you having input. It's an important issue for our country right now. And I think the work you're doing is great. And thanks so much for being with us and continued success. And feel free to come back anytime. We would love to have you again as a guest.
Well, I'd love to be back on the show. And thank you very much for having me this time.
Okay, thanks. Okay. You know, we end the show every week with a song. We dedicate it to our guests. And this week we had two great guests with Asher Hildebrand and Aziz Huck. But last week we also had two great guests, Dr. Laura Brown and Ruth Bingott. And I thought they disagreed with each other. But in the end, it seems like they agree more than they disagree. But anyway, here's a song about disagreement from Mr. Mason. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.